Welcome back to Beholder to No One, a TTRPG podcast. Today I'm here with another Nikki, halfling Nikki, spelt the same exact way, which is wonderful because there's like a thousand ways to spell Nikki.
Truly.
Somehow. How are you today?
I'm good. It's Saturday and I'm a teacher, so.
It's very early.
I've been up for hours because I never sleep in anymore. Sleeping in for me is 7:30 a.m., so.
Oh, dude, same. Yeah. It's a weekend. I went to bed at 3 and my body's like, 7:30? Yeah, it's time to wake up. And I'm like, do we
have to go? How dare you have fun on a weekend? Now you must be awake.
But today we are here to talk about neurodivergency and why TTRPGs appeal to people who have neurodivergencies. I am a new member of well, technically I've been part of it, but I'm newly diagnosed ADHD as of last year, which explains so goddamn many things. So many things.
It's like that TikTok where it's like, can we stop revealing that my personality is just my mental health disorders and trauma? Like,
so many things. Like, honestly, now that I'm in therapy and not have a diagnosis for ADHD and PTSD, just like so many, and also found out I was demisexual, just last year was an awaken call of like, bam, oh shit. That explains so much between those four things. Okay, cool. Awesome.
Yep.
And then you play the, also, you have a lot of autistic traits. Do you want to actually take that test? And you do one online and it's like, you're just right on the edge. I'm like, I don't know if I want to get diagnosed.
I was straight up right on the edge when I thought about how I feel with my friends. I was full blown. It's like one point away from you're definitely autistic when I thought about how I feel at work. And so now I'm just telling people I'm autistic because I probably am. I'll never get a formal diagnosis because the world is very discriminatory. Like, I couldn't immigrate. Like, right now, I'm considering immigrating to New Zealand, and I couldn't if I had an autism diagnosis. They won't let me. So,
interesting.
They also, in this country, they don't let you foster children if you have an autism diagnosis, and a lot of adoption agencies won't take you. So, like, if I ever wanted to foster children, I couldn't. So I will never seek a formal diagnosis, and I really don't feel a need to.
It doesn't really do anything. Like, it doesn't, it's not like there's any treatments or stuff. It's mostly coping mechanisms, which a lot of us have taught ourselves how to do or, like, done our own research.
Yes.
And some of the autistic things fall under ADHD as well. So the combination of the two, you kind of just figure out what works. Like, I get sensory overload very easily, especially with noise specifically. And also, like, I have the thing where I get very angry when things get canceled. Like, my instant reaction is very angry. And, like, then I have to, like, I stop saying something. Like, I had to teach myself to, like, not react when things get canceled and let the back, like, the actual thought process happen where it's, like, I hope you feel better.
Yeah.
And not just be mad because, like, it's irrational for me to be angry and I know that. So it's, like, okay, no, I want you to feel better, I promise. I'm just really annoyed that this got rescheduled, but I do want you to feel better with, like, all of my heart.
Right, right. I know my tone doesn't sound like it, but I am rooting for you.
Thank God for text. You can, it's like, oh my God, I feel better.
Gosh. So I don't like having serious conversations in person. And like, I request that it be done, like, via text or via chat room, whatever, because I cannot modulate my tone. And tone and body language are, like, everything when you're having high-impact conversations where people's feelings are hurt. And I just, it doesn't work. And so I stopped having those conversations, like, live in person because I can't. And I take a long time to process things. So, but yeah, I didn't get diagnosed with ADHD until 2020. And it was because, so I'm a teacher, like I said, and there's bells for everything, right? And you always have one student who will keep you on track. They'll be looking at the clock all the time to make sure that you're going to lunch on time and specialist on time and all these things. Well, when we went to remote learning, I didn't have the bells and I didn't have the students telling me, hey, we're supposed to be over here right now. And I kept missing appointments and I kept missing meetings and I kept, like, just having a really hard time with it. If I wasn't at my computer with Outlook doing a little bloop, bloop, bloop whenever I had a meeting, I would miss it. Somebody would be like, hey, see you in 5 minutes. And then I would be 10 minutes late to that meeting because I would have forgotten in that 5 minute span.
Yeah.
And so I finally got diagnosed, and now I have a 504. So I really don't need a formal autism diagnosis because my 504 for my ADHD through work gives me all of the accommodations that I need to be successful at work. So
Mine was because when I quit my job in June of 21, my entire life, I have had a very structured schedule. Like, I was in music classes, I was in art classes, I was in sports. Like, I was terrible at sports, but I was in them. And I just, like, was doing something from, like, wake up to bed. And if I wasn't doing something productive, I was reading. So, like, I was always doing something. And I didn't realize that my anxiety was covering up my ADHD because, like, I had such a structured schedule. And if I didn't do, like, homework or something, like, I would stay up late doing it because I was too anxious to not do it. And I was afraid of, like, disappointing my parents and them getting upset that I wasn't getting good grades. So, like, I got good grades all throughout all of school until my senior year. I went right from there. I went to college. And then I had, like, 10 months-ish where I wasn't doing a super structured schedule. But then I went back to a super structured where shortly after I was working full-time and going to school full-time. So I was just always busy. And then when I was working full-time, I started a publishing company. So I was always busy. Publishing company closed and it was podcasting, always busy. So I just, like, always kept myself proactive. Mm-hmm. So I never realized that at work, me getting there and being hungry because I always eat when I get to work, and then me getting hungry at 12 because I always got ate at 12 o'clock. Those were the cues that I actually had to remind myself to eat, not anything else. So when I stopped working in a corporate office, suddenly because I never understood why people forgot to eat. Like, you just get naturally hungry, right? No. It'd be like 4 o'clock. I'm like, why didn't I eat anything? Why am I dizzy? Oh, food. Right. That's the thing. I started realizing I couldn't force myself to work anymore. I also went through major burnout, which did not help any of this. And I started to, like, just realize that I was having a harder and harder time focusing. I always knew that I was bad at, like, remembering things and remembering things for, like, times and stuff. But I've always used Google Calendar, like, repetitively. And being poly, you have to do that when you have multiple partners anyway. And then also being a tabletop role player and being in multiple games or recordings is just, like, a godsend. Without Google Calendar, I would be lost. If it's not on there, I will straight up forget. Even if it's a weekly thing, I will forget that it exists.
Hey, so two things I wrote down. So anxiety and ADHD, there's this theory that a lot of people will be late diagnosed with ADHD because you'll get to a certain point in your life where your anxiety is managed really well, mm-hmm. or you don't have that anxiety anymore. And so your ADHD symptoms just go through the roof. And the anxiety was the reason that you were doing the things that the world expects us to do.
Yeah.
And so being on time to things and finishing projects in time and those sorts of things, that all happened because of my anxiety. And so as soon as I wasn't as anxious anymore, my ADHD symptoms went through the roof, time blindness, hyperfocus, all of these things. And then the thing I wrote down about calendars, every morning I look at my work calendar and my Google calendar. And if it's not on either, I'm not going. Like, I can feel like there's something like this recording. Remember, I was like, I feel like I have something on the March 4th, but it's not on my calendar, so it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So I was really glad you checked with me.
Yeah, I tried a message because it helps with the rejection sensitivity dysphoria portion of it, where people mm-hmm. cancel last minute or don't show up. So I just, like, I try to reach out, like, the day before, at least, preferably a week before, and say, like, hey, we still good for XYZ time, blah, 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 because I know there have been times where people messaged me and they're like, hey, are you still good for the session zero? And I'm like, what? What session zero? What did I agree to? Because it was, like, a passing statement and we were in the middle of doing something and I needed to, like, I didn't open my calendar right then and there and put it in there. So it didn't happen. So with the anxiety thing, so I found that out through TikTok, which a lot of people mm-hmm. are, like, angry about that people are finding it out through TikTok. But, like, at the same time, it's like, you see yourself in the videos and you're like, wait, that's an ADHD trait? That's an autistic trait? That's a what trait? Like, shit, that explains me perfectly. But the anxiety ADHD one, I was just like, are you me? Like, what is happening?
Yeah, that keeps happening to me as well. And what was funny is when I took the RADSR and I scored really high. Like, I think it was like 159 when I thought about how I feel at work versus how I feel with my friends who are the majority queer and neurodivergent. So like I feel normal with those friends. I don't feel like an alien with those friends. And then I took the autism quotient and I scored, I think it was a 35, and it said 92% of autistic females score 32. And I went, interesting. Then I took the masking test and I scored super high. I scored higher than the average for autistic women on the masking test. And I went, huh, interesting. And so then I messaged my friends and I was like, I think I'm autistic. And one of them goes, oh, I thought you knew that and that you just didn't use that label.
Don't you love that?
And a very good friend who's also a therapist said that to me. I told my therapist and she said, oh, I thought you knew that. You just didn't use that label. Great. So that's two therapists now. And then one of my closest friends goes, yeah, I thought it was really weird when you said that you weren't autistic. I was just like, okay, yeah. Well, this is fine. And so I think that when I brought it up on Facebook, my dad was like, really? That doesn't make sense to me. And I said, Dad, do you not remember when I was a child, all the times that everyone said called me picky, mm-hmm. all of the times they said I was being difficult, all of the times I had a full-blown meltdown because there was a tag in my shirt or my dress that you guys wanted me to wear was itchy, or throwing a fit because you wouldn't let me take my socks off. Like, do you not remember that people would say that my voice was too loud or too shrill or too high or too annoying or that I talked too much? And I was like, and then remember in high school, middle school, it turned to, oh, she's a snotty brat because mm-hmm. I had resting bitch face or because I,
yep.
my tone is not modulated well. I'm too honest because I will just straight up tell people things, like not in a mean way, but just like I call my observational questions or observational statements that like, I'm just telling you that this thing that you just did made me uncomfortable. That's not a judgment. That's an observation. Or if I ask like an observational question and people, neurotypical people get so upset about those observational questions and start making excuses instead of answering them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, I was making so many people uncomfortable just by being me. And I went, do you not remember that? I didn't have friends. My dad was like, ah, yeah. This actually tracks. And then one of my friends was like, really? That surprises me. And I was like, really? She goes, well, you do make sure that your needs are being met and you're very adamant about it. So I was just like, yeah, that's one of them. But there's like TikTok floating around that's like, oh, you think I don't look autistic? That's because I'm super hot. Wait, did you just call yourself hot? Oh, did I say something socially inappropriate? But it's like, but that's how it feels being like being an attractive woman, like being told, not being diagnosed until I had to like self-diagnose as an adult. And then just being so like uncomfortable my whole life in just every setting, mm-hmm. Except when I'm playing games with my friends. And I like my structured make-believe so much. I love drama so much. But when you're like getting all these diagnoses and you're thinking about your trauma, because I also have a PTSD diagnosis, and I'm looking at my trauma through the lens of first being queer, then being diagnosed with ADHD, and now I'm going back through all these experiences mm-hmm. that I had growing up that would have been different if people knew I was autistic.
So I did take the RADS school test as well. That's the one that I took. I got 126, I think, and 130 is the mean score of autistic people, strong evidence for autism. Mm-hmm. I was like, interesting that. But like there's stories of like when I was little, I refused to be dirty. So like mm-hmm. if I was in the sand, I just like, up, nope, get me out of here, please. But I also, another story is I hated non-beef hot dogs. I still hate non-beef hot dogs. Like I refuse to eat normal, like regular.
The texture is weird.
I just, yeah. So my parents obviously wanted to buy the non-beef hot dogs because they're significantly cheaper and we were broke. And they tricked me one day and I was like three, maybe four. This is what they've told me. And they bought non-beef hot dogs. And I went, the child who did not want to be dirty went into the trash to prove to them that they were non-beef hot dogs with the wrapper, so that I was like, you lied. And It's just, and it makes sense because I used to, like, I was always quiet, but when I was around my friends, I was fine. But even now, when I'm around friends, I'll still, like, get quiet when there's too many people because it's too many things happening at once. And I have safety foods at every restaurant. Like, I'll order something and it'll be the same thing I order every time I go to that restaurant, no matter what. The biggest one for ADHD was the hyperfixation. It happens with video games and crafting. So I've tried.
It happens to me with people.
Yeah, that happens too. I've done like literally dozens and dozens of different crafts because I saw something online that looked cool. I was like, ooh, I want that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do that. And then I do it and then I never do it again. So I've sculpted something. I've sewn dresses. I've done diamond art. But like as soon as I finish the first one, maybe the second one, I'm like, I'm good. I don't do that anymore. I'm good. Writing a novel? Sure, I could do that. Yeah, I did it once. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah, I think the hobby graveyard is strong with a lot of ADHD folks. The things, and I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I cannot spend any more money. I live by myself now. So I cannot. I need to use what I have and create a new hobby for myself because I cannot buy any more things.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, like, I love short run TTRPGs because I love the novelty of getting to do new game, do new things and play with new people and play new characters and all those things.
Yes. I used to love long-term campaigns and I still do enjoy a long-term, like I would like to have like one long-term campaign, which I currently do have one, but it's going to end this year at some point because it has 5 seasons. It's a podcast and stream and we're in, I think, the second half of season 4 right now. But all my other games have been short-term ones. Like we'll do 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off, 6 weeks on, and we switch it up. Or we'll do like 4 sessions or we'll do 6 total sessions and then like then we're done. And it's been really nice because I've gotten to have all these stories and play all these games with people, with like hundreds of different people, whether it's like a one shot or like 4 episodes or whatever. And that also means I get to try a bunch of different games. So like I am bored as hell of D&D now. Like I've played so much D&D. I love it. Don't get me wrong. Like I'm getting a D&D tattoo sleeve. I love D&D. Beautiful. But I've played it so much that there's very few people who can make it interesting for me to want to play in a longer term campaign. I'm like, but this could be like Lancer, or this could be Shadowrun, or this could be Cyberpunk, or something like I want more sci-fi.
Shadowrun is so complicated to learn.
Shadowrun,
yeah,
it is. Shadowrun's mechanics aren't great,
yeah,
but the lore is fantastic.
So I used to be a part of like a professional game masters guild here in the Seattle area, and one of their big ambitious goals for when we ended the pandemic, which is probably never going to happen, but one of their big ambitious goals was to do a live, like, in-person Shadowrun LARP in Seattle and, like, have GMs run the game live. But yeah, live Shadowrun, in person, like a LARP, but using the Shadowrun mechanics in Seattle. And I was just like, that's very ambitious. I don't want to organize that. Have fun with that.
I want to play in it, kind of. But, like, honestly, like, there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. I think somebody needs to make a Shadowrun LARP game like they do with Vampire the Masquerade. Because, like, I like Vampire the Masquerade as a concept. I know it has its... Vampire the Masquerade has a ton of problems, specifically specifically racism, which... I believe I talked with Paul about in a couple episodes ago, because Paul was the one that pointed out to me and was like, oh yeah, let me tell you why it's racist. And I'm like, okay. But the LARP is completely different, not in the racism part, but at least in the mechanical part, from the actual game. And the game mechanics at first are really confusing for V5. It's pretty easy to catch on. It's nowhere near as confusing as Shadowrun. Especially 5th edition, or 6th edition. But I've done the LARP before, and it's literally like you get a page, and it's like rock, paper, scissors type of stuff. And it's just very fast-paced type of thing. I want to do LARP again. I was supposed to, but I stopped going on dates with the person who was supposed to take me. I could just go, I guess, by myself, but that requires me to do things by myself.
Emotional support human.
I'll find somebody to go with me, I'm sure. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, the last party I went to, I brought a friend. Like, I was like, I can't go by myself. When I started going to my friends' house parties again, because they had like outdoor parties in the summer. And so when I started going again, the first time back, I had to bring my friend with me, who's never met any of those people. But it ended up being that once she got there, people knew who she was because she runs a pretty popular Instagram account. And so we ended up having a lot of fun. She had a lot of fun too. But I was like, thank you for coming as my emotional support human, because like making sure you were having fun made it to where I had fun. Even though like my friends are cool and they're all, the majority of them are queer, the majority of them are neurodivergent, they're all theater kids or cosplayers. So it's like, you know, my friends are really cool and I love them, but it had been so long since I had spent time with that many people. Yes. That I was just so nervous to go. And I have RSD, so like,
same.
I'm always afraid that everyone's going to hate me. And then every time I leave a party, I go, oh man, that's the last one they invite me to. And then they still invite me. So I'm not unlikable. I don't know why my brain still thinks that I am. And I do know why. I do know why. It's trauma. It's based on the fact that growing up, people did not like me. And when I told one of my therapists that, who I stopped seeing because she just didn't get me, but I told her that and she went, but is that true? And I was like, you sweet neurotypical baby. Yes, it's true. They literally told me to my face they did not like me. They started a petition to send me back to my mother in Idaho because I was living in California at the time with my dad. They had literally started a petition and raised money to buy me a plane ticket to send me back to my mother. Little did they know how abusive she was. So it was just like, really, guys? I wish I could go back in time and just shake them all and be like, you are picking on somebody who's already been kicked. Like, you gotta stop.
Yeah. But I also have RSD, which for those who don't know, that stands for, it's rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And it's where you, like, you don't handle rejection well generally, but also, like, you find rejection in places that it doesn't exist. So, like, I get that too. After every game, pretty much, I have, like, imposter syndrome / this is the last game. I know I fucked up. This is the one that they don't like me anymore, which a lot of my friends who are also some neurotypical ones, but also neurodivergent ones specifically, will make sure to say something after a game. Be like, that was really fun. I really enjoyed it. Or we'll, like, have, like, an aftercare type of session afterwards where we just chit-chat for a little bit and, like, wind down, make sure everybody's okay. But the ones that like really affect me have been like the cancellations of things. So like Sunday, for completely logical reason, it made sense. My last Sunday game got canceled. The person had to take their dog to the vet, and makes perfect sense. Like, take your dog to the vet, please. That did not stop me spiraling from like, nobody wants to play with me. Or like, if somebody is late to something, there's a logical reason for it. Does not stop me from thinking, oh, they realize they hate me now. They finally realize, it finally clicked. It took them X amount of months, but they finally clicked that I'm not a great person and I'm not the person they want to hang out with. And logically, like, I know that that's not true. And logically, I know that they have told me multiple times, multiple people have told me differently. But my brain is just like, no, 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 they're all lying. It's like, why? Why would they lie? I don't know. They're just lying. They want something. It's like, I offer nothing. Other than friendship, like, I don't, it's not like I'm a sugar mama or something like that.
They don't gain anything by being friends with me. They're choosing to. So to circle back to the thing about like growing up and getting picked on, and that's why a lot of us, especially queer neurodivergent people, have RSD in the first place. So part of our health curriculum in Washington State is a lesson on self-esteem and about the ways that people feel low self-esteem, and that's through not feeling like they belong, not feeling like they can do things, not feeling appreciated. Mm-hmm. And I teach my kids explicitly, because I teach fifth graders, so they're 10 and 11, and they're old enough that they're starting to get this like view of the world, and they're starting to understand how things work, and they're starting to care about how the world works. Mm-hmm. And so I get them before they go to middle school, and I try to set them up for success to deal with puberty and big emotions and all of these things. But I'm also trying to protect kids like me and students who are like systematically oppressed by the system. And so I explicitly teach them. I ask, which kids are the kids who are most often victims of bullying. And we list it every time we have a lesson on bullying, because we also have some really good, it's like kind of cheesy, but it's really well organized social emotional lessons and curriculum that we use. And every time they bring up bullying, they never explicitly say that it's queer, neurodivergent, students of color, and poor kids who are the ones who are most likely to get bullied. They poor never gets brought up.
Too.
Huh?
Sick kids too.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and we talk, and kids with disabilities, like we just like in general. And so I try to bring it up every time, and we list it every single time. And I tell the kids I was bullied, and I explain why I was bullied, because they need to understand that I had to explain to them that I am 36 years old and those things still affect me. And so your words and your inclusion will impact people's lives and might save lives. Because, and I tell the kids, even the shy kids can be upstanders against bullying, because they can include that kid and be like, I'll be your friend, you know? Mm-hmm. And I tell the kids every time, if I had one person who was willing to be my friend when the other group of girls was picking on me, that would have been enough to make me feel like life was good. Like I would have loved to have just one friend. And if I had had that support, things might be different. And so that's one of the tools I give my students. And I'm like, even the shy kids, you can do this too. You don't have to stick up for them against a bully. You can just be their friend. And that's going to mm-hmm. be enough for them. The other thing I wrote down I wanted to say was Stars and Wishes is so important for helping people like us who have RSD. It's like, let's sit down, let's do Stars and Wishes. And so for people who don't know, this is a really great safety tool that is used after the game. And we do them after every game. And I do require them for any game I'm in or that I run, it's required. And then I do ask my GMs for our channel to do this as well. And they don't have to, but they need to have some kind of aftercare. But I love Stars and Wishes because everyone gets a star. We all pump each other up. I get told that I did good. I did a good. And then with wishes, that's a great opportunity for people to share what they want to happen. And sometimes that reveals things that they didn't enjoy. Yeah. And I need that because I need to know if I made somebody not enjoy it, or if they didn't enjoy it, but it wasn't because of me. You know what I mean? Or like they're excited to do more stuff with my character, or whatever wishes they have will help me and my brain and how it works. So I really wish more people did Stars and Wishes for that reason.
I love using Stars and Wishes. I keep forgetting that it exists. I used it for a lot of my professional GM games. And I'm like, okay, what was your favorite moment? And like, it gave bonus experience points to people for participating. Like whoever had like the best moment. And then I'd always make sure that I would find something that if somebody didn't get voted, I would find something that for that person too, so that they would still get that perk. I didn't get extra bonus points, but like somebody usually, because I specifically in all of my games had at least one friend that didn't pay to play. They just were a friend. And they would usually be the one that's like, oh, I really enjoyed this part. Thank you for letting me do that, or like whatever. Because I'm very go with the flow improv DM. So in Waterdeep, there are these giant statues. I think they're called the walking statues of Waterdeep. Yeah. And she pointed to one of them. So she pointed to the Hawkman and sent message. Now technically, these were all like automatons of sorts that came to life years ago, centuries ago maybe, and helped defend the city. And then they fell wherever they stood was when they got turned off and this thing ended. And I was like, well, that's boring. So she messages this guy and gets a response from the Hawkman. Because why not? And the Hawkman, there's not much details about him there's not much details about any of these things. So I was like, you know, there is a little bit, there's a little piece of him still deep up inside, but the rest of him has been turned into like an apartment building. He just got hollowed out and like turned into an apartment building. So he's like, wait, you can hear me? And then she would just sit there for 2 hours talking to the statue every day. And it was like adorable. It was like the sweetest thing ever. And I'm like, just because I let the random statue have a thought process.
So great.
They started working on ways to like build another place for it to get out of this body and into a new body, so it would like be able to walk around again.
That's awesome.
But yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then they all like said, I will ask for like, some players will like, I will with wishes. I'm like, where's my cute goth girlfriend? I would like a cute goth girlfriend, please. Or like, you just like someone hot. I don't know. Just a romance of sorts, please. Like,
yeah, I always ask for a romance. I will not play. Even if it's a one shot, I will not play if no one's romancing my character. So either the GM or the other players have to give me someone a romance because I am a slut. Affectionate. Parentheses affectionate.
I personally will play without romance because there are games where it comes up now.
Yeah.
Or there are games where I've had a girlfriend and they like passed away or something in the backstory. Because like I will let my, like literally. Mm-hmm. So I did a Shadowrun where the dice determined my past. I have a trope evidently, which I've mentioned a couple of, all of my partners, something terrible happens to in games and they mostly die. And I'm like, what? That's not true. And then I started thinking about a lot of my games and I'm like, so big that we actually joked that we want to make a, where all the players are dating me in a polycule and trying not to die. And I'm like, I love you all and I hate you all at the same time.
That's very funny.
But in this particular game, my friend jokingly was like, so do you have a dead girlfriend or boyfriend in this game? And I was like, evidently I do.
That's so funny.
And like, he kept asking questions and evidently he's like, did they have a sibling? Yes. A little brother. I was like, yeah, I think I told the little brother I would make sure that she'd come home. And that's what turned out to be the bad guy who was going after to make me understand how it felt to lose. And I'm just like, that's thanks.
So like, if I'm not romancing someone mm-hmm. or like have fun backstory with me, I love collaborative backstory. And I think they really enhance. And as a person who grew up not having friends, I've all that connection. And so having that connection built into the game is always fun. And that's actually how I became closer to one of my closest friends. And it was very fun.
Hello. Sorry for the interruption here, but I wanted to give you an advertisement for one of our friends in the tabletop community. Please give it a listen and go check them out.
What happens when you get a bunch of truly nerdy scientists together and force them to play tabletop role-playing games? You might be surprised. Nature Check is a TTRPG channel you can find on Twitch, YouTube, and podcast apps everywhere. Join the fun as the cast explores fantasy worlds and connects your favorite gaming moments to real-life science. If you like TTRPGs, ridiculous jokes, and nerdy fun facts, then Nature Check is the show for you.
Now, back to the show. I think for me, a lot of the things that I've done in tabletop games are to help me with some of the things that I didn't get to experience in reality, because like I was a late bloomer in high school. I was very shy, introverted, didn't realize it was because of anxiety or depression. Like I knew I had them starting around 15, 16, but I never got diagnosed until I was in my 20s. I was also chronically ill, which meant I got made fun of a lot for my psoriasis and my weight, because I gained weight because of medications. And when I started doing tabletop games, sorry, backtrack. I didn't realize I was demisexual till last year. So I've always had a hard time finding partners. Like I've had maybe two, correction, I've not had a hard time finding people who were interested. I had a hard time finding a connection with that person. And I didn't realize that's what the problem was. So out of like 15 people that I've been with, like two of them, I had like a connection before I went polyamorous, at least, and knew I was demisexual. And I could never figure out why. So then in tabletop games, I was like, well, I can just pretend to be like normal in my brain and like be able to flirt with whomever I want. And it's okay. Because like, now I know I'm demi and I can't just flirt with random people. It's weird for me. And I can't just go on dates with random people because I understand I need a connection. But in my tabletop game, I can be pansexual and do whatever the fuck I want. Just flirt with everybody. I love playing flirtatious, sexualized characters in some games just because it's entertaining. And I won't hit on anybody if it's inappropriate. Like if they ask me not to, I'll be like, I always ask at the beginning, who is okay with this?
Right.
And sometimes the game is like not meant to have romance, but like I see something budding and I will private message the person and be like, hey, do you see this as well? So like my favorite scene, do you know Archival Dust Bunny or Anna?
Love Anna so much. Anna was in our Haunted West campaign. She is such a good RPer.
Yes, Anna's amazing. We played a game, Up River, Down River, which is a fantastic story. And in the story, I brought a character We played the game on my channel, and I brought that same character into this story. And then Anna wanted to be my first mate, which meant she wasn't my first mate in the first game, which meant I had to have a second ship, which meant this was our third ship now, our third attempt trying to go upriver or downriver to find the source. And we were just friends. We were really close friends that she was like by my side and the last two surviving members of the last ship. And all the ghosts of our ex-shipmates were on the ship with us. So this time we're going out, and then there's a scene where at the end where there's a giant lake. And when you get to that lake, you get hit. All of you have to make a roll. And basically, if you fail, which I could not succeed, I literally could not roll high enough to succeed. My character needed help to get out of it. You basically have a PTSD episode, and you are frozen in fear as you are reliving your worst experience as a character. So my character was reliving the two ship crashes where she lost all her crew members, where she blamed herself for all of the failures. And in that dream, she kept like reliving everything that she did, trying to fix it, knowing it wasn't her fault, but still not believing it. And that was when Anna messaged me and was like, hey, I have an idea. Are you okay with blah, blah, blah? And I said, yes, go for it. And that's when her character realized she needed her and she loved her and wanted, like, she's like, you can't leave me. Like, you need to come back to me. And that's what helped my character then be able to roll with help to get out of this episode so she could like snap out of it and like realize she's had this person with her all along. And that's when that character realized, my character didn't realize until we actually freed all the ghosts and like that weight and that burden that she had put on herself was gone. And she realized like her partner in crime this entire time was who she had to have with her and was there, even though she was like beating herself up this entire time. Mm-hmm. It's just like cute fucking moments like that I love that just like naturally come up into the game and make sense. If it's forced, it doesn't sound as like, not forced in the sense of like forcing the other person, but just like, let's make it work. We're going to make a romance. Then it's like less fun. But when it's just, when it like naturally occurs, it's so much fun.
So we actually started Los Casados, which was our Haunted West campaign, with a relationship that had been estranged. So Cameron, who's Will Smith underscore Cam on Twitter, played my estranged husband in this game. And we were Irish immigrants living in a place in Texas that our kid passed. And we were dealing with the trauma of that. And Anna played like the town witch, who was like a tarot reader and all these things, but knew a lot about spooky stuff. And apparently there was a demon that was after us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so heartbreaking. It was so good. The whole campaign was so good and so heartbreaking. But Anna made me cry on the last episode that we recorded. Anna's character, Alice, sacrificed herself so that we could have our kid back. And Cameron and I both cried. it was like the last episode, and it ended with us getting our kid back and being a family again. And then we made her cry because I was like, oh, you know, like, of course we got back together and had more kids, and our first daughter definitely would have been named Alice. And Anna's just like, but she had written us the most beautiful letter, like in character, and it was just, it was really cool. And the GM for that was D20X Tina. And Christina is an amazing GM and played our little ghost kid throughout the series, who I couldn't see, but Cameron's character could. And so it was just so heartbreaking. And we had Dana there as well. And Dana's also really amazing RPer. And so is Finn Vox was in that as well, and who's also a really good RPer. And I'm like, we got to do a season two. We're going to come back as different characters, but we got to do a season two because there's a lot of really interesting stuff that has been built into that story, and I just want to play with that table again. And I invited Anna for that table because I had played in a one-shot with her, mm-hmm. and knew that she had it, you know, that it, that she's so good at RP, and she's so good at these, at getting really into character. I love her. I would put her in every game if I could, but she's so busy.
Yes. I've played in quite a few games with her. Right now, it's like super future, it's not announced yet for when it's being released, but I'm recording with RTO with my partner, Fen, and then Anna and Paul, who are really good friends, are also in the game. So I get to play with Anna, and I get to see her playing a different character, and she sees right through my character's bullshit, which is hilarious to me. I'm not gonna give any spoilers, but my character is just really fun. Basically, she's like, the only thing I will say is my character has had quite a few concussions in the time of war and maybe lying about being cleared for duty. Maybe she probably should not be working with these people. And Anna's character is the only one that was like, you just lied when you said that you were cleared for duty. I know you lied. What is your game? Like, what are you trying to do? I don't know. I just won't play. It's fine. Don't ask. So tabletop games with neurodivergencies, I think one of the biggest things that it does help with is learning how to do a lot of things that you aren't naturally good at, because your brain doesn't work that way. So like you said earlier, like your tone tends to be very straightforward and like hard to control or understand, like get your point across, because someone who is neurotypical will not understand the meaning, they'll like look for hidden nuances behind it versus like exactly what was being said, which is an issue I have in reality too, because I will say something and I will mean exactly what I'm saying. There isn't hidden context. Like,
so a really good example of this like hidden context thing, if I ask, did you take the dog out? And the response is, a reason why it hasn't happened. That's not what I asked. I know that neurotypical people will ask you passive aggressive questions like that because they want to be mad at you, or they're trying to figure out if they're supposed to be mad at you. I just want to know, did you take the dog out? And if you didn't, that just tells me, okay, cool, I'll take the dog out. Like, I don't need a reason why you didn't take the dog out.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yes. I've taught myself how to word things in specific ways through my job. So I have learned now, which is a type of masking of sorts, because I was naturally very blunt and I got in trouble for being blunt. An example, at my old job, I was a quality analyst and I built the manual that would help answer most of the questions that people would have. It took me months to build this thing. So I'm like, use it, please. And somebody came up to me to ask a question. And my first response, because I was very busy, was, did you look in the manual? That was it. That was the question. She went crying to my manager that I didn't want to help her and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I just asked if she looked in the manual. And she said no. And I said, then look in the manual first and see if it's there. If it's not, then come back and we'll find out the answer. But later I was taught by a mentor, like how to properly say things, and like how he would do it was, like, there was one example where I had to talk to a friend who's like a really chill friend. Like, they were super chill. So I wasn't concerned about it. And he's like, how are you going to word this? And I said what I was going to say. He's like, okay, so here's what could happen if you talk like that. And he explains, the way I worded things could make that person defensive. And when he explained it, I'm like, oh no, you're right. Now that you're saying it back to me, I would get defensive instantly. Because like, I would hear, you made a mistake. What are we here to, like, how are you going to fix it, is how my brain was going to word it. And he's offered a suggestion. He's like, try to place yourself against the company with him instead and try again. And I reworded it in a way that was more like, hey, I know this isn't true. And I know we're like, I know that you've been working, but the company thinks that you haven't been clocked in for 2.5 hours every morning because you've been working on a special project and you didn't know that you needed to log on to the phone and actually hit ready in order for it to recognize that you existed as a human being at the time. So how we, so putting him with me, can fix this is by doing XYZ. And then going forward, the company will no longer think that you aren't working when you are. And it was just like, that way he can't get defensive against me because I'm on his side. He can get defensive against the company, which is a horrible place anyway. And they're an entity of their own. And it kind of like helped me realize, like, it did, that conversation alone helped me learn a lot to deal with my adopted foster care child, who's 20 now. And there's so many times where I've used that same logic of like, pause, think about how to say this so you aren't misinterpreted. So I do a lot of, hey, friendly reminder, if you didn't take your medication, please. Especially if like, I've asked them 3 times already. There are days where if they're being bratty, I'll be like, take your fucking medication. Like, just go take your meds, please. For the love of God, just take your meds. But it has helped a lot, especially when things are bad. But I have a hard time showing my fear and worry about certain things. And they worry about a lot of things. So then they don't see me worrying. And then they think I don't care. When I'm like, no, I care. It's all up in here. I just researched it and the likelihood of that being a problem is very slim. So I'm not going to worry about it till we have proof that it's a problem. Mm-hmm. I have enough anxiety. I don't need to add to that anxiety with every possible problem that could exist in this universe. So I'm going to wait till we have a doctor tell us that that's a problem before I concern myself with it actually being a problem, or I am not going to survive.
Right.
And there's only so many times you can play tabletop games.
Like, right. To bring that back to the tone and things like that with tabletop games is that TTRPGs has brought me so much in my life. The majority of the people I'm closest to, I would not be friends with them if it weren't for meeting them on Twitter playing TTRPGs together, which is such a bummer because there's so much toxicity on Twitter and in this community that like it can be such a bummer. But I know that there's also a lot of good that it can do. And structured make-believe with my friends has given me the ability to make connections with rules included. I know what the rules are. I have been told what the rules are. We require an RPG consent form on our channel that I've beefed up. So I took the one that Kanna Shaw made and then I beefed it up even further. And I'm going to be redoing it again because CJ, aka Scholastic Dragon, gave me a really good idea for how it could be beefed up even more. But like using that and then using the rule set that a TTRPG comes with just gives me all of that structure that I need. And then beforehand, especially with, I really like PBTA games because they have all the character connection questions.
Yes, I love the character connection.
Same. I have a friend who runs D&D professionally and does those character connection questions for D&D, which is also really cool. But having the connections built in has really helped my brain a lot with being able to socialize. I'm an extrovert, so like I need people, and people were my special interest. I talked all the time growing up, and I'm a vocal stimmer, and so I turned that vocal stimming into talking all the time and singing. And then I turned all my physical stims into socially acceptable things like dancing. But the point I'm trying to make is that if it weren't for the structure that that provided, I might not be as close as I am to the people that are my closest friends. And the other thing is, like, when you're lonely, even if the people at the table you're with aren't your friends yet, you'll become friends over time if you play enough, because you tend to bond over what happens to your characters. But even if it's not even dramatic, it's just, hey, that was really fun and funny. Like, I'm glad that we got to do that. You start to bond with them. But even before that, your brain still feels like you've connected because you got to play together and you got to play characters who know each other. And I think that that has been so helpful because I always say I'm a naturally lonely person. I need people, and people were my special interest growing up. I have a degree in psychology and a master's in teaching because I wanted to understand how brains work. But yeah, that structured playtime has really helped a lot with not feeling lonely and with making friends and giving us that structure to socialize, especially as I find more and more that my friends are also autistic or ADHD at least, and we all needed that connection. And yeah, so it's just nice. It's also just nice when you're dealing with the real world that's so hostile to people like us, queer people, people of marginalized genders, you know, that kind of thing, people with disabilities and pain disorders and chronic illnesses and all these things. It's nice to be in a game where you can affect change and like you can help your friends and you can be powerful.
Yeah.
Especially as a person who has, I have fibromyalgia. So I spend a lot of, I say that like 90% of the time, my pain's at 75%. Like I never have a pain-free day. And then 10% of the time, my pain's so bad I can't do anything.
Yeah.
And so when you get to be powerful, it's really powerful. It's really important. It's really important and significant to be able to do those things.
Yeah. I have chronic low back pain because I have like three different things going on down there between I've had arthritis since like I was 13. I didn't get an x-ray until like 20 something. And even then they didn't believe me because of my age until like I had to yell at them and be like, I don't want pain meds. Just prove that I have something wrong, please. And they're like, oh, hey, your spine's pushed forward and pinching the nerves. That might be why you had Charlie horses your entire freaking life. But okay, thanks for finally answering. So like on a normal day, I'm probably at like a 4.
Mm-hmm.
So like I can ignore it for the most part. I'm more focused on my anxiety than the pain. But like on a bad day, like a 8 for back pain, like the only thing that will hit it will, like I have to smoke like a bowl of weed or something, and that will make it go away or at least tone it down. I refuse to take pain meds other than like ibuprofen. I will take Excedrin for my migraines, which I get less of. I got them like twice, 2 to 3 times a month, so bad that like I needed to go home.
I was getting them daily. I was having daily migraines for a full 2 years.
I am glad I was not doing that.
It was awful.
I believe that. But I would get headaches all the time, but like to the migraine light sensitivity aura issues, like that was probably 2 to 3 times a month. And that has minimized. Like I've had one migraine in the last month, and it's because I'm working from home. I'm in an environment that is darker, which is the biggest issue because I'm very light sensitive. And the first day I had an actual migraine in my new job, I've been working here for like just over a month and a half now. I had a meeting with my boss and he saw like the physical pain on my face, and like I had the light off because even that light right here is like too bright when I have a migraine. And he's like, "Are you okay?" I'm like, I have a migraine right now. I'm hoping it'll go away. I took some Excedrin." And he's like, "You need to take the rest of the day off. You can. It's okay." Like, I'm like, what? Like, we have a meeting in 2 hours. He's like, "I'd rather you not have a migraine when you're focusing on that meeting than suffering and trying to focus." And I'm like, I was so confused because mental health days too, because I took one mental health day. And mm-hmm. I just literally was like, "Hey, I'm not having a great day. Are you cool if I take a mental health day?" And he's like, "Yeah, go for it." Instantly, no questions asked. And I was very confused because my old boss would be like, "You know, it's very inconvenient of you that you need to take tomorrow off because you're depressed. Everybody else has to request off 2 weeks in advance. Why should you get special treatment?" I'm like,
"Because I will not live if you don't let me have time."
It's like, I can't plan my depression. And also, I don't take vacation for a reason. All of my days off are for mental health days or migraines, yep. Literally, or maybe a convention once in a while for 2 days. Like, please just, I made sure my work was done. I worked through it all today. So everything that's due tomorrow is done and turned in and submitted. Please just let me have a day off. Otherwise, it's going to get worse. And she gave me shit about it. I'm like, "Fine, I want next Thursday, Friday off then. Because now, bitch, I'm going to take 2 days because you said, yeah, I can have 1 day tomorrow." And sure enough, the next day, depression hit really hard. She's like, "Why are you so in such a mood today?" I'm like, "Because I didn't get the day off because I'm depressed. Like, I'm here. I exist. You are getting the bare minimum because that's all I can provide to you."
Right.
If I was home, I would be sleeping right now.
I want to plug real quick Cephaly for migraines. I got that little machine. Very expensive. Very expensive. You can pay for it with an HSA. If you have an HSA, it's covered. But it's a little machine that you put on your forehead right here in between your eyebrows and a little bit above, and you put little electrodes and it shocks this nerve right here, and that's what stopped me from having daily migraines. It got so, like, I would be at work, and you know what's nice? I went from banking, B-A-N-K, because people always hear me say baking and they think, "Oh, you made cakes." No, I worked in banking, which is the worst. Mm-hmm. Before, so I'm a second career teacher. And if I had issues with in there, I would use up all of my sick days, and then I would have to use PTO, like my vacation days, for my sick days as well. Mm-hmm. And then I would run out, and I would still just have unpaid days, and I would have to like request them. And I'm like, "You guys hired somebody who has a pain disorder and who gets sick really easily. Like, what do you expect?" But with teaching, I got a migraine at work towards the end of the day last year on Halloween. So we were having our Halloween party, and the kids are all, it was just a lot. It was like sensory overload. And I was dealing with those daily migraines that I was having. And my coworkers came in to drop, one of my teammates, student teacher, came in to drop something off. And he saw like the look on my face. Like, it was very much unmasked. Like, clearly I'm in pain. The lights are dimmed. And my students always know. I always tell my students I have a pain disorder. I tell them I'm neurodivergent and that sometimes I get migraines. And so that student teacher was like, "I'll take your kids outside. I'll take them outside. We'll do our snacks and stuff outside. And the rest of the day, you can just chill." And so he took my kids so that they could go eat like cupcakes and stuff outside and take pictures with this little prop that we had. Because this was also when we were still having to wear masks at work. And so the kids couldn't eat their snacks inside unless we took them to the cafeteria or whatever. And so he took them outside. I turned off the lights and I laid in the floor. And then one of them brought me a soda water because I always get nauseated with a migraine. And so one of them brought me a soda water and I just laid in the floor in my classroom library because I have these like cushions in there for the kids to lay on. Mm-hmm. And I would just lay in the floor. And it's amazing. So that was also the thing where like teaching was the first profession. I had coworkers who liked me. And my girlfriend was like, "Interesting that it would need to be people who are in a caring role, who are educated about how brains work." And that he would finally find people who appreciate who you are, because my need for everything to be exactly my way and perfect is fine because I have my own classroom and it doesn't impact other people. Mm-hmm. Especially since my students are always so well behaved because of all that structure that we have in my classroom and the rapport I build with them. But like when I was in banking, I would forget to do stuff all the time and it would get me in trouble because I would get distracted. And my coworkers didn't like me because I needed everything to be a certain way. And if you didn't do it that certain way, it was wrong, which technically I was correct. Because
you're pointing it out and that pissed them off.
Exactly. Technically, I was always correct. Like there are legal precedences for the things that I would tell them, like, "Hey, you can't actually set that account up that way. It has to be done this way." I was the one that they asked to write this training manual for the small bank I was working for. Mm-hmm. And so I would be like, "It's in the manual. It's in the manual. You can't word it that way. You have to word it this way. This is the type of account that should have been. These are the paperwork you needed to have before you could open that account. You cannot open an account without this legal paperwork." And just those like observational statements, telling them what was wrong, hurts people's feelings. When you work in teaching, I don't have to be in charge of adults, but I get to be in charge, and it's very nice.
Yes, I feel that 100%. I have a terrible memory, and I know it's partially because of the ADHD, but also probably partially because of traumas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I... And with my anxiety, I want to always write things down exactly how they're supposed to be done. So I started taking really good notes for myself when I was learning new things. And that meant I started to create the manuals for things. And then people were like, oh, how do you do that? And I showed them my instructions that I made for myself. And they're like, can you make that for something else? And I was like, sure.
I loved it.
I am a technical writer now. Like, I am a technical writer in my current job because of this. Like, for 9 years at my old company, I just happened to step into that role because they were like, well, we need you to help build this. And I was like, okay. And I was the one that learned it. So then I was the one that had to build the manuals for it. Then I was the one that had to train people for it. And then I became the person who had to do the quality for it. And my instruction guides were really, really well done, which is one of the few things that I am confident about in my abilities. Because I make sure that it has, if it's used to train somebody, it has visual, it has written, and it has verbal, because you'll be speaking it out loud, but then also you can have them do it with you. So all that covers all of your ways of learning, however they learned. If you had a multiple group place, they would learn their way. So when I'm making the manuals now, they're like, oh, well, you could just like, no. I need specific details of what is going to happen. Why is this here? Why is this needed? What happens if this happens? Like, I'll have like 60, 70 questions for like 7 pages, which is how it's working so far with my new job. But I did that for 9 years, and literally they just would say, go to this person, learn how to do this job, write instructions for it. And I'm like, okay. My bachelor's degree, my thesis or capstone was I went to a doctor's office and I built their front end staff manual on how to do their job. And then I added stuff in it that I learned from working at a call center to improve their call etiquette because it was terrible. Because I was sitting like 5 feet away typing on a computer and I could just hear them. And I'm like, oh God, that's not how you answer phones. But I wasn't like allowed to say anything. So I just like wrote it down like, hey, office manager lady person, here are some suggestions. Because I don't think this is how you should talk to your patients.
Right.
In my personal opinion, slash as a patient who's seen doctors all her life, I would be upset if you talked to me like that. But when I finally was looking for like a new job, I was looking for either project management or technical writer. And I don't have the official title technical writer to back up my skill set. But I have 9 years of experience in a corporate office. And then also I've helped do developmental editing, which is very similar to technical writing for 2 tabletop games. So it's like, I know I can do it. And then I enter the place, get very overwhelmed with all the things because there's so many things. And then I'm like, is this documented anywhere? And they're like, no, that's why you're here. And then my eye twitches a little bit. And then I realize the more I talk to people, how little documentation there is. And we had a meeting recently, and he's like, is there anything that could improve in the company? I'm like, well, one I'm working on, but that's, you have no documentation on like literally anything, and it's very frustrating. 2, I would like paid time off, please. That would be great, because that's like the one thing I don't like about working at the company. Like, I love everything about them. They are fantastic. People are nice. Pay is great. Like, health insurance is fantastic. Get sick days. And I understand why they don't have it right now, and I think it'll be happening in the future. But I'm just like, that's like, those are really like only 2 things.
Yeah.
Just being honest, like, those are my 2 things.
So my bachelor's is in psychology, which is not super sciencey. I mean, it was. Biology was one of my special interests. So I took a lot of biology classes. And I could have gotten, it wouldn't have taken me much to get a bachelor's in biology as well at the same time. If I hadn't been undiagnosed ADHD, I probably could have pulled that off. There was no way without medication and that I would have been able to do it, or accommodations, which I didn't realize I really needed. I asked so many professors for PowerPoints to be printed for me so that I could take notes on those instead of trying to write everything down. And like, some gave them to me, but some just were like, no, I'm not doing that because then you won't come to class. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I love coming to class. This is my happy place. But anyway, so I did research with, she was a psych professor, but she did her research out of hospital in, I went to Boise State University in Idaho, and she did her research out of the San Alfonso's hospital out there and researched things like traumatic brain injury, stroke, that sort of thing. And I was the head of our stroke program eventually. It took me about a year or two, and I was the head of the stroke part of our research. And I ended up revamping our entire, I wrote the manual on how to read the medical documents that the doctors would give us. So we would intake a patient or participant in the study. We would get their medical files with their information, like their contact, like their personal information scrubbed. But we would get all of the reports, like the what happened, where the injuries were, what the doctor saw in the brain, that sort of thing, those kind of reports. Mm-hmm. And I would read, so I went through and had to reread them because I noticed a couple of mistakes and I went, this doesn't make sense and here's why it doesn't make sense. And the head of the research team, like on the student side, said, you know what, I think you're right. Let me present this to Dr. Seibert and see what she says. And so then they took my information and they went to her and they said, hey, Nicole's noticed this, like what's happening there? And she said, she's right. Like, this isn't accurate. This is what happens when people who don't study biology try to do these forms. And they had me go back through all of our participants. So this was like over 100 participants in this study. It was a long-term study on the effects of stroke on the brain and recovery times and that sort of thing. And once I went through and did all of that, it impacted the results. It impacted our data. So it completely changed things that were before that were statistically significant in our data. And then took things that weren't and then made them significant and then and completely changed what our focus was.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just so incorrect. I ended up writing a manual on how to read those and what the terms meant. I had to sit there with a medical journal about the brain and a medical terms journal that doctors use and all of the files and go back through and take meticulous notes, print them out, and revamp these files to make our research more accurate. It was so much work, but so worth it because I was able to make these things more accurate. What we ended up finding, so just FYI, as people get older, women are less likely to get the stroke care that they need because they have the less common symptoms, because everything in the world is based on white men's experiences. And so a lot of my participants who were women were told, oh, you're having a panic attack, when they were having a full-blown stroke.
Yeah.
And so just keep that in mind, folks who are assigned female at birth. you are more likely to have what is considered the less common symptoms of things like strokes and heart attacks and everything else under the sun that could unalive you. So make sure that you don't just listen to the whole like, oh, your body weakness, but that's what people usually, facial droop, that sort of thing is what people usually, and headache are what things people usually associate stroke with. But in reality, for women, it's double vision. The headache will be there, but double vision, muscle weakness, that sort of thing. But the double vision was one that that affected almost every single female participant we had and very few of the male participants we had, which was really interesting because then they were like, oh, that's a panic attack. I'm like, panic attacks don't give you double vision. Like, what?
Yeah, that's why also ADHD was misdiagnosed with people too for so long, because for a while, like I know that it used to be, it's no longer separated ADD and ADHD, but for a while ADHD was just like the hyperactive version, and that's what they would see, the mostly younger boys who would like super hyperactive and super like jumping and squirrel, and they like were audibly changing, where I do that, but I have to be in a very goofy mood sometimes. Like, I'm not super hyperactive, but I will do, like, literally if I see a bunny or a squirrel, I will literally say bunny and like get super excited. But most of the hyper, like, I have inattentive version, which is what ADD used to be, but my brain is constantly going still. You just don't see it going unless you know my facial expressions and like things like that, which some people do, and they can see and they're like, okay, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
You're spiraling. What's happening? What's going on in there?
It could be good things too. They could tell because they're like, what are you smiling about? Like, oh, just a thing in my head. Like, don't worry about it. I'm laughing about a joke that was told to me 2 weeks ago. Like, don't worry about it.
I just, that one sentence you just said made me think about this other thing, and now I'm just reminiscing. It's nice.
Yeah, exactly. Which is great. Like, that's the beauty of ADHD, right? Like, it can be really shitty, but I'm sorry, I forgot to ask if I'm allowed to curse on this podcast. Should have done that a long time ago, but it could be really crappy to have ADHD. There's a lot of negative experiences that we go through based on it. But there's so many cool things. Like, for every sensory sensation, like sensory experience that I hate, there's one I love. Like, most people don't experience the music the way that I do. They don't experience the feel of a fuzzy sweater the way that I do because of how my brain works. And it makes me a better teacher. I usually have the highest needs students in my classroom when it comes to sensory needs and behavioral needs and that sort of thing, because I most often make really easy connections with those kids, realizing now it's because my brain works like theirs does. And honestly, kids' brains, even if they're neurotypical, kids' brains work a lot like how people who have sensory issues work. They get overstimulated very easily. You need constant reassurance. And so all these things that make our lives hard to live in a capitalistic society, but there's also so many benefits that I really enjoy. My students also get away with nothing because I'm easily distracted. So if you're off task, I will notice because I will see that you're not doing what everyone else is doing and I will get distracted by it.
So on that note, where can everybody find you on the internet?
Yeah, so you can find me everywhere as Halfling Nikki. So it's Halfling, like the little creature, the little critter in D&D, but in the Nikki, N-I-K-K-I. That's on TikTok, Instagram, Hive, and Twitter. And you can catch me most often on TEATRPG, my Twitch channel that I co-created a couple of years ago. Our focus is having a place for marginalized folks to get to play games. And so we take that mission very seriously. And soon, not sure when this will come out, but I will be working on a Star Trek show with Critical Misses. They're having their second or third season of their Star Trek show, and I have been invited to be on that. And Noir Enigma and I have started, are working on a talk show. So I already host one talk show, and now I'll be co-hosting another. So should be cool.
I will put all the links down below to what does exist already in just Twitter if it doesn't exist. But that is awesome. It was lovely talking with you. This was a lot of fun just talking about like ADHD and stuff like that and getting to know how it works for other people. If you want to find me, you can find me at Beholder to No One on Twitter or on TikTok or on Instagram. Though Instagram is really just selfies of me in my makeup for random streams. You can find me on streams on Tuesdays and Fridays on 2000 Tales Roleplaying, both on Twitch and YouTube currently. Weird Web is currently back. This episode is going out on the 20th. I might not be in this Friday's game. I'm not sure. I'm either not in last Friday's game or this Friday's game. I'm visiting peoples that are important to me. But Weird Web is fantastic. That's at 9 p.m. on Fridays. After Weird Web is done, we will have a hiatus game. And then the finale, actually, of our Masks game is tomorrow, the 21st, at 8:30 p.m., which is the Big Gay Dice game, or Big Gay Mask games, where all of us are queer as fuck and just get to be superheroes that all have our own problems. I have toned down significantly the work that I am doing. There will be a big announcement made in about 2 weeks or so here, so keep an eye out for that, and hopefully by then I will have what everything that is happening in the future is. So keep being awesome. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Hey, before you go, I just wanted to let you know that this episode was edited by Matt over at Walsh Animation. They are part of the Table Party podcast, and I wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to them, especially because Matt has been such a freaking lifesaver when it comes to editing the discussion episodes recently. So please listen to this ad for Table Party podcast and go check them out and make sure you give them some love. Thanks.
What makes Table Party different from other tabletop podcasts?
The music.
The setting.
The characters.
The gore.
A bunch of different games.
The refreshing coldness of ice cream.
The 300-foot-tall squid named Delilah.
The dice rolls.
The horrifying body horror.
The aroma.
The suffering of my players.
Dairy Queen blizzards.
The luxurious plush texture.
The free coupons.
Bad decisions.
And who can we expect?
I'm Kelsey.
I'm Matt.
I'm Gabe.
I'm Walsh.
I'm Chris.
Welcome to the Table Party.
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 Welcome to the Table Party.